Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
In this episode of Northgate News, we'll explore what happens when cultures collide. From a proposed oil tax to save California's public education system, to a new law in Uganda that could make homosexuality a capital offense. From marijuana's impact on the environment to a little town in Ecuador known for its troop of mischievous monkeys. Proposition 8 banned gay marriage in California. But in Uganda, the fight for gay rights is a matter of life and death.
In Uganda's capital city of Kampala, it's hard to escape the influence of religion. Faith is a big part of this nation's identity. Almost all of the city's 1.5 million souls are devoutly Muslim, Anglican, Catholic, or the fastest growing group, born-again Christian.
All these laws that we make stem actually from the Bible and from the Quran.
First-term member of parliament David Bahati is a born-again Christian. Last fall, he introduced a controversial anti-homosexual bill.
As Christians, as Muslims, we all believe that it is wrong, and this is backed by our faith and by the holy books that we use.
Homosexuality has always been illegal in Uganda and punishable by up to 14 years in prison. But the new bill calls for the death penalty. Gay and lesbian activists are defiant.
Not even the president of Uganda can take me out of my country for simply being who I am.
I'm just living my life like any other average Ugandan.
You can be out of the closet in Uganda, but still not out in public. Because many gays and lesbians have been shamed or assaulted, they trust almost no one. But after a few days in Kampala, Kasha Jacqueline invited me to meet her friends. A bumpy yet safe distance outside the city. Kasha and her friend Gerald Sintango are activists in Uganda's gay and lesbian movement. Her political awakening began when she heard a televised address by Uganda's president.
And the president said there are no homosexuals in Uganda. And as already a known lesbian. And I said there are no homosexuals in Uganda. But I'm here. And I know a few other people.
In 2003, Kasha formed Freedom in Rome Uganda, a human rights organization dedicated to lesbian, gay, and transgendered rights. Gerald works for the umbrella organization Sexual Minorities Uganda. He keeps the secret from his mother.
I don't want her to know about my sexuality because I believe she will die. She will die.
Bahati introduced his anti-gay bill a few months ago after a conference at the leading Pentecostal church in Kampala. That's where three American evangelicals warned Ugandans that gay people were infiltrating their schools.
They try to entice young people into it. It's like you can promote, you know, somebody into taking drugs, and then eventually they become addicted.
At the moment, I have over 60 former homosexuals whom we are taking care of. You know, they have abandoned. They were forced into this.
And they could say that person. They could identify people.
Oh yes,
they
give us a lot of information.
No one gets recruited. Who would want to be part of that very painful what? If it is not from the heart, who would want to be crucified every day? You are recruited and you are being crucified. Would you want to be part of that pain, part of that isolation, part of that discrimination if you are being recruited? No!
Evangelical missionaries have long been active in Uganda, where believers have more than tripled over the past 30 years.
Since 2003, Uganda has received almost $300 million from the Bush administration's emergency plan for AIDS relief. Almost a third of that money is directed to faith-based organizations. They generally support the anti-homosexuality bill. International leaders like President Obama are speaking out.
Odious laws that are being proposed, most recently in Uganda.
Even well-known pastor Rick Warren is distancing himself from the bill.
With a law that I had nothing to do with, I completely oppose and I vigorously condemn.
Politicians point to school recruitment as the main motivation for the bill. But the bill itself is far more comprehensive. And what few Ugandans seem to realize is that it requires family, friends, and neighbors to tell police if they witness homosexual activity.
According to the bill, I should report. If I don't, I could be punished.
Bishop Christopher Sunyonjo is one of the few Ugandan religious leaders who supports gay rights.
People were saying there were no homosexuals here. But it's wonderful, because the more they try to suppress it, it has come up. Now it is not that they are not there, but that they shouldn't be there. That's why we have this anti-gay bill.
He paid a heavy price for his views when the Anglican Church excommunicated him. Nevertheless, in some ways, the country is progressive. Parliament recently passed a domestic violence bill, and over a third of the seats in Parliament are held by women. Still, the anti-homosexuality bill seems likely to pass.
Here in Uganda, we don't have sexual minorities or sexual majorities. We have a heterosexual arrangement.
Even now, if Parliament were to vote, they would overwhelmingly vote in favor of the bill.
I wanted to ask religious leaders why they support the bill, but I came up against a wall of silence. Stephen Longa, a Pentecostal church elder who hosted the anti-gay conference, finally agreed to talk with me when I called him from California. So would you say there's a separation between church and state?
Yeah, I think there's a separation between church and state. But the values that the church teaches are needed in the state, whether you like it or not. There is what is right and there is what is wrong.
It's statements like these that make gays and lesbians worry that Uganda is shifting from a secular to a religious state.
Men of God are now going in parliament now. They will start asking for a representative in parliament. Then they will start dictating which laws govern this country.
Well, if the law is passed, then what happened to them is obvious.
I knew trouble was coming, because really you cannot introduce a death penalty in the 21st century unless you're really willing already to act upon it.
In the meantime, people go about their daily lives, but there is mounting concern about what will happen this summer when Parliament debates the bill.
And I tell those who want to use their position to intimidate Ugandans, to threaten Ugandans, that they should mind their business. On that one, they will not succeed.
If they think or they feel that I've committed a crime for sleeping with another woman or for loving another woman, and they feel that I should be hanged, let them go ahead and hang me.
With the California budget draining funds from public education, some student activists are taking the fight to Sacramento. But there are no easy solutions.
We have plenty of room. There's a lot of entrances to the Capitol. It's crucial to get there because that's when we're going to put everybody in their groups and teams. We're going to go over the talking points again and try to bring out the stories, you know, that you may be able to tell.
On March 22nd, community college student Christina Cannon led students and faculty from the San Francisco Bay Area to a march in Sacramento. It was one of several protests that month at the state capitol and throughout California against recent budget cuts to higher education.
We have faculty and staff and students all uniting from the 112 community colleges. This is a really powerful statement.
Ken and other students and faculty took their message directly to legislators' offices. Billions of dollars of cuts have hurt the quality of education.
I mean, I've never seen a situation like this.
Jeffrey Michaels is an English teacher at Contra Costa College.
We have unprecedented demand. We're slashing classes as fast as we can. 50% of our incoming freshmen can't get a math or an English class. You know, we're cutting back on the arts severely.
All of your continual involvement will help significantly in just spreading the word about this movement, because it's actually turned into a movement.
If legislative aide Shirley Kim sounds like she's on the students' side, that's because her boss supports them. Assemblyman Alberto Tirico is traveling to colleges around the state, proposing a solution to the funding problem.
There is a solution. It's AB 656. It's an extraction fee on all companies.
AB 656 is the official name of Tirico's bill. The bill would charge a tax of 12.5% on each barrel of oil pulled from the ground in California.
Are they going to tell me about the AB 656 is the oil severance tax to generate $2 billion annually in revenue?
While Cannon campaigns for Tirico's bill at community colleges, sophomore Ian Magruder is promoting the tax at UC Berkeley.
I'm holding AB 656 pledge cards right here, and we've been distributing these here on campus. They're trying to get signatures to really build a groundswell movement for this legislation.
Supporters of the bill say it's justified because outside of California, most major oil-producing states already charge drillers a severance tax. But 300 miles from San Francisco, at the southern end of California's Central Valley, the answer to the state's revenue problem seems less obvious to those who would pay the new tax.
You know, going after a single industry is an easy answer, and going after the oil industry is a tempting target because we've never been an industry that has been loved.
Chris Hall owns a drilling company in Maricopa, in oil-rich Kern County. He points out that California oil companies already pay a special property tax on the value of oil in the ground.
The studies that the industry has had done and that various legislature staffs have looked at show that California, for what they're paying in their share of taxes, places in about the middle of the top oil-producing states in the country.
Hall also says adding a new tax on his industry will hurt his ability to invest in new wells. But he'll find little sympathy among students like Christina Cannon.
So I think I'm going to try to work harder and passing around to get signatures for the bill so that we can do our part as citizens to support the bill, because we need this to pass.
Without the support of Republican legislators, the bill has little chance of passing, and Republicans are unified against it.
I'm going to vote no, and I'm going to speak out strongly against it.
State Senator Roy Ashburn serves on a committee set to review the bill.
Any tax, if you think about it, is going to be paid by the consumers.
At UC Berkeley, political linguist George Lakoff says the bill will probably never pass because Democrats make up less than two-thirds of the legislature.
In order to get any revenue whatever for anything through, you need to get a two-thirds vote.
Lakoff wants to change those rules so legislators can raise taxes with only a 50% vote. He's filed a ballot initiative to make that happen.
If you just took the students in UC, CSU, and the community colleges, and they all signed a petition, it would be on the ballot.
But with Lakoff struggling to gather enough signatures and little chance of passing the oil tax, it's unlikely that higher education will receive more money soon. In the meantime, students like Christina Cannon are facing tough decisions.
So actually today, this is good news, I've been accepted for my housing at Idaho State University. So I for sure have housing, which is awesome.
As much time and effort as she's invested in politics, the difficulty of being a college student in California has led Christina Cannon to pursue an education elsewhere.
It just makes more sense. They have the classes available. I don't want to be somewhere where I can't learn and foster my education in a timely manner.
There is a small town in Ecuador where monkeys live side by side with people. But not everyone appreciates this monkey business.
This is Misawaji in the Ecuadorian Amazon. Villagers here live close to nature, and nature lives close to them. Everyone knows each other, and there's hardly any crime. Well, except for the monkeys. Misawaji is a peninsula and port populated by around 4,500 people. most of them, belong to 35 Quechua communities who live alongside with immigrants from elsewhere in Ecuador, who live mostly in the little town. The Quechuas are known for eating monkey from time to time, but that hasn't stopped a troop of wide-fronted capuchins from making Misawayí their home.
Se les tiene como una mascota, digamos, de aquí del pueblo. Una mascota.
Sí les acaricio, sí me han dado uno que otro un beso. No hay uno que le gusta besar.
Ellos, como siempre, me piden pan. Y cuando es guardado el pan, ellos abren, huelen y botan. Ellos les gusta pan fresco. Y yo siempre les digo, en broma, pásenme 10 centavos porque esto cuesta. Y ellos se ríen, pero me hacen... Y después cogen el pan y se van.
Ya les conocemos más o menos la personalidad de cada mono.
There are about 15 of them, and the villagers notice the newborns, and some care enough to bury their dead. The monkeys are always looking for food, and they seem to love the tourists, and the tourists feel the same.
I love monkeys, because they're fun. They remind me of myself. I love to climb all over things. They have little personalities. They smash things. They always try to get in your bags, too. Little thieves. Little fingers work quickly. But they're so much fun to watch. Are they dangerous? No, they're not dangerous. They're a lot of fun.
Tourism is a big source of income. These capuchin monkeys are important to the economy of the town.
You probably get treated better than I do. You kidding? Free food, free room and board. They're great. They love life. If I was a monkey, I'd live here.
Trato de pegarles. Le desmando y en ocasiones se ponen agresivos y tratan de atacar a uno.
¿Usted cómo les ha tratado de espantar a los monos?
De mil maneras, hasta con agua hervida.
Norma Paredes is one of many who had enough. It's one thing for tourists to play with them for a few minutes. It's another to live with them all the time.
No. Nunca me gustaron los monos, porque son muy traviesos, malcriados, se meten a las casas, cogen las cosas, abren las refrigeradoras, sacan, botan, se llevan todo lo que pueden, todo lo que encuentran.
They will let you pet them, but just as long as they decide. Sometimes things get out of control, if you are mean or don't give them what they want. Beware of your water bottles, because they will take them. But then they even steal from each other.
Inclusive ahora estoy intentando poner electricidad arriba para que no vengan.
¿Y si se mueren, se electrocutan?
Se mueren.
The monkeys arrived here 20 years ago when the owners of a local hotel brought a number of different species.
Le dirían nosotros que no estábamos de acuerdo que haya un zoológico para tener a los animales, sino que vivan en su ambiente natural. Entonces, ¿qué pasa? Que de toda la raza que trajimos, la única que prevaleció fue el mono machín.
Villagers freed their monkey pets and the family started growing. Three generations later, the pack leader is Peco. Everyone knows him. No one dares to mess with him, not even his own family. Anthropologist Michelle Field studied the Misawayí monkeys for a year. She says that this species is particularly adaptable.
They call them the poor man's chimpanzee because they're smart and capable of using tools and that sort of thing. And as a whole, all of those monkeys are what are called extractive foragers. They manipulate their environment in order to get their diet. So in this situation, instead of it being a log with a frog inside of it, it's a backpack with a zipper. So it's just a different extractive foraging technique.
There are some who think the monkey should be taken to an island far from people.
Y estaba allá para irse los monos a la isla del frente. Pero los guías se opusieron, que por los monos viene el turista, que no sé qué.
Sería también bonito, ¿no?, ponerles de un lado aparte y que estén ahí solos, pero también, yo también he pensado mil veces, y si exponemos allá una comunidad, A lo mejor los señores indígenas se vayan a comer los monos, no sabemos. Después vamos a perder el único atractivo que tenemos.
Recently, the town leader brought in a new female. After a few days of getting to know her, they will let her out.
Y lo que necesitamos es que haya más, que se expandan más los monos, que haya más monos. De eso vivimos aquí en Misahuayí, la mayoría porque conocen a Misahuayí como el pueblito de los monos, dicen, ¿no?
There are town kids who know that if you want to have a really good time with the monkeys, just rub onions on them. Then there is María del Carmen, who shares the chontacurro, an Amazon delicacy, with the monkeys inside her own restaurant.
No, los monos aquí son una bendición, son un regalo que nosotros debemos cuidarlos.
In an Amazon town like Misahuayí, the relationship with nature is more intimate. They never really planned this experiment, but the town has become a laboratory where people and monkeys share the same village.
This November, Californians will vote on a ballot initiative to legalize marijuana. But no matter the outcome, the large-scale cultivation of cannabis is already a concern for environmentalists.
Along the horizon, you can see a touch of yellow, mostly right over there. You can see the smokiness. Part of that is the mists of Humboldt, but part of it is from diesel generators.
They call it the Redwood Curtain, a region of California that's famous for its beauty, secrecy, and marijuana production. In these remote hills, pot growers power their operations with diesel generators. And one careless mistake can mean the kind of toxic spill that happened here 2 years ago.
You can smell the oil in the air. It's not gone 2 years later.
600 gallons of diesel polluted the creek. The health department says there have been more than 50 such spills, and those are just the ones that people came forward to report.
Because marijuana is illegal, we don't talk about it. The growers don't talk about the problems because they don't want people to think that marijuana is bad. It isn't bad. It's because it's illegal that bad things happen.
One grower would talk about it, but he asked us to conceal his identity.
When your neighbor lives above you, he has a spill, and you're getting your water from below him, your spring water, your drinking water, it kind of puts you on edge.
The different things for me that are disconcerting about the way in which marijuana is grown here is it's at an industrial level at this point.
Melinda Stone was born here and owns an organic farm on a remote mountain. The environmental impacts of marijuana, she says, are tied to its scale.
The kind of effluent that is leaching into the creeks all over the place has everything to do with this intense farming that's going on.
Anywhere that people are growing rurally, off the grid, they're growing with diesel generators. The hills of Humboldt light up with generators at night. You can hear the hum of them.
The cities are humming, too. Humboldt State University researcher Peter Allstone studies energy use, and he noticed that the county has been using way more power than the rest of the state.
We saw a huge jump in residential energy, and being a resident of Humboldt County, we knew right away what we were looking at.
Indoor grows use a shocking amount of electricity.
For on-grid growing, we estimate that it's about 90 million kilowatt hours a year, and we estimate that it's about that much off the grid, too, where people are using diesel generators to provide that electricity. That's 20% of all the electricity in Humboldt County.
That's enough to power 13,000 homes for a year. Marijuana is big business, but illegal growing isn't taxed. And some growers even get PG&E to subsidize their power bills.
They have very low reportable income, and so they qualify in many cases for this program that's subsidized by the entire ratepayer base.
We're not even the counties that grow the most marijuana. We're the ones that are sort of like culturally known. The bigger counties are actually the same counties that bring us our tomatoes and our vegetables, and that's even more heinous out there.
...75% of what we find is on public, state, or federal land. So you're talking about campgrounds, state parks.
Places like this in the Sequoia National Forest. According to law enforcement, drug trafficking groups connected to Mexican cartels are diverting water from streams to irrigate their plants. Some poach animals when they get too close to the grow. and they use a lot of chemicals.
Trash, herbicides, pesticides, rodenticides, all of which can eventually leak into the water systems, affect critical habitat. So you're talking about an environmental issue that's significant.
Significant and often overlooked, because when law enforcement shows up at a grow like this one, they remove the plants and leave the trash and chemicals behind.
I wish we could come up with a better system or an easier one, you know, a more efficient way to get that stuff out, because it's a lot that gets left behind.
And what's left behind is all the tools needed to start growing all over again. The California Bureau of Narcotic Enforcement says they don't have the time to do this cleanup, but other agencies do. The Forest Service says they don't have the money or the manpower to get to all the sites. So Shane Krogan and his all-volunteer crew come out to help finish the job.
We're looking at about probably a mile hike out.
This grow site is 50 miles from Yosemite. It was raided 2 years ago, and the debris has been sitting here ever since.
I get out of here and I just start burying my head and trying to get this stuff up because it makes me feel really bad.
What's worse is that in some of the most remote, pristine places in California, many grows are never found. And of the ones that are, it's estimated that only about half get cleaned up by anyone at all. We spoke to 7 different state and federal agencies, and none of them were tracking the chemicals or studying what they do to the environment. Which raises another question. If pesticides and chemicals are bad for the land, what do they do to us?
Some of the pesticides are very toxic, and depending on the dose that's still present on the flowers, one can develop just acute flu-like symptoms, nausea, vomiting, things like that. And depending on dose, you can actually have some neurotoxic effects.
We went to the International Cannabis and Hemp Expo at the Cow Palace in San Francisco to ask people if they were worried about chemicals in their pot.
You shouldn't have, like, pesticides or, you know, be grown unnaturally.
Well, I'm sure if they label them differently, as in, you know, one used with pesticides and one without, I would obviously choose the one without.
But in a legally ambiguous industry, just beginning to find its public footing and with one foot still in the counterculture, how do you really keep track of what's safe and what isn't?
You can't really just take the word of a grower that they've grown organically.
Stephen D'Angelo started Harborside, a dispensary in Oakland where they take extra steps to screen their marijuana.
How can we really call it medicine if we don't know what's in it, if we don't know that it's safe?
So Harborside works with Steep Hill, a lab which will soon begin screening cannabis for pesticide residues.
We've taken it upon ourselves as a movement to start taking measures to address the safety and the health of our patients.
It all comes down to the fact that marijuana in California operates in a legal gray area.
Do you think legalization could potentially prevent some of this?
Really not going to go there with you.
It's a really difficult thing to say it's black or white or this is the easy fix or the easy answer as opposed to something else.
Marijuana is providing hundreds of millions of dollars to our local economy every year. That goes along with the spinning meters that you can see when you walk down the sidewalk.
Why do you think it's hard to talk about these things openly?
It's illegal. You know, it's been an outlaw culture for almost 40 years now.
But in the last 40 years, marijuana has become a full-fledged industry, worth an estimated $14 billion in sales annually. No longer an illicit crop in the hills, it's a big business that's stepping into the light. And as it does, Californians are getting a clearer picture of how it's really impacting the state.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.